All right, we're going to go ahead and get started. We've got a good amount of press, and they'll filter in very shortly as they log into the WebEx press event. So this morning, we're having the media teleconference on the measured size of the Gulf of Mexico dead zone and efforts to predict and mitigate its effects. My name is Paul Mickle, and I'm the co-director of the Northern Gulf Institute, which is located at Stennis Space Center on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. The Northern Gulf Institute, or NGI, is a cooperative institute with NOAA, and although NGI and NOAA are both hosting the event, I will be your moderator today. Today's teleconference is the measured effects of the Gulf of Mexico dead zone and efforts to predict and mitigate its effects. Just a few logistical details to share with the group, and then we'll get started. After I introduce the panelists, they will provide statements, and then we will open it up for Q&A from the press only. Everyone will be in listen mode only, the Q&A to mitigate any background noise. During Q&A, please indicate in the Q&A section on the right-hand side of your screen that you have a question. We will recognize and unmute in the order that they are received. You can also just write the question in to the chat side. I'll make sure to read it. If you are calling in, we will unmute all callers at the end of the Q&A to be recognized and to ask questions. We want to make sure if you're on a phone or a computer, you still have the ability to question the panel. This event is being recorded, and if you have any objections, you should disconnect at this time. If you have any follow-up questions or need additional information, you can submit them to sheila@hpc.msstate.edu, and I will put that email address in the chat side box shortly. Just a few minutes ago, NOAA posted the news press release highlighting this year's cruise results, along with additional information useful to this press group. It can be found at NOAA.gov on the left at the News and Features section under Latest Media Releases. So let's go ahead and get started. I'll introduce our panelists, and then we will start with their statements. So next up. Our first panelist is Nancy Rabelais. Dr. Rabelais is a full professor at Louisiana State University. She's also a distinguished research professor at the LUMCON, or Louisiana University's Marine Consortium, and she is the chief scientist on the survey cruise that we'll be talking about today. Our next panelist is David Kidwell. He's the director of the Competitive Research Program at NOAA, National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science. Next panelist is Bruno Piggott. He's the Deputy Assistant Administrator of the Office of Water at EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and he sits as the proxy co-chair for the Hypoxia Task Force. Next panelist is Secretary Mike Nagy. He's the Secretary of Agriculture at the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship for the state of Iowa, and he is the co-chair for the Hypoxia Task Force. The last panelist is Lori Sprague. She is the Program Manager of Integrated Water Availability Assessments in a Water Mission Area, and she is at the U.S. Geological Survey. So these are our panelists, and we're going to turn it over and let them provide their statements, and then we will head into the press Q&A. So our first panelist is Dr. Rabelais. Go ahead, Nancy, go ahead and unmute yourself, and go ahead and I'll let you know if there's any issues.
Okay. Can you hear me? Because I have no way to unmute.
Yes, we can hear you just fine.
Okay. All right. Well, there's probably the expectation that the area would be smaller this summer because the river flow is also very low, and I'll give the details on all that as I go along. The size this year was, and I'm going to try to do kilometers and square miles as I can, it was 7,920 square kilometers, which is 3,060 square miles. And the river discharge being low was at about 300,000 cubic feet per second. Now, all of this occurred because of the drought conditions throughout the majority of the Mississippi River watershed from moderate drought to extreme drought. Most of the areas with low oxygen were between the Mississippi River and the Atchafalaya River, where there was stratification or layering of the water column so that hypoxia or low oxygen could be supported and maintained by the differences in the salinity and temperature from the upper water column to the bottom water column. There were very few signs of river influence out on the continental shelf in the surface waters this year because the saline was calm and the waters were beautiful blue. The salinity was mostly about 30 PSU or parts per thousand, which is approaching the full salinity of the northern Gulf of Mexico at 35 to 36. There were stations where it was stratified or layered, and at those stations, if it was hypoxic, the differences in salinity would be 30 to 36 parts per thousand, and without, it would have been 34 to 36. There were indications of high organic loading based on the chlorophyll biomass that we saw, and that was mostly at the stations, of course, where the hypoxia was measured. And there were also, that would indicate fluxing, the fall of diatoms, living diatoms to the bottom. It would indicate the fall of dead or decaying phytoplankton to the bottom, which all supports the bacterial decomposition and loss of oxygen in the bottom layers. At times, the graded phytoplankton was higher than the living phytoplankton, so it was an organic matter driven process to reduce the low oxygen. Now, everybody's probably wondering about the water temperature this summer. It was not 103 degrees as it was in Miami, at least in the newspaper a week ago. The surface waters were, and here I'm going to switch to Fahrenheit because that would probably make more sense to many of the listeners. The surface waters were about 88 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit, which is a little bit warmer than last year. But the difference depends on how close to shore and how deep the water column is. The bottom waters where the hypoxia occurred were about 75 degrees centigrade. And the surface waters there were close to 80 to 88, which is more of a reflection of the air temperature at that time. It was a quick cruise, but it tells us again, once more, how important the long-term data set is for looking at the variability from year to year. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Ravelet. All right, so next panelist, and again, a reminder to the group, we'll do questions at the end, and you can ask them to the panel in general or to a specific panelist. And next up is David Kidwell from NOAA. Go ahead, David, go ahead and try and let me know if you have any issues on your mute.
Thanks, Paul, and thank you for you and the Northern Gulf Institute for hosting us this morning. And thank you, Nante, for your work in documenting the size of the zone this and for the past many number of years. It's an important metric for us to gauge a number of efforts that you'll hear about here shortly from some of the other speakers. As Paul mentioned, I'm Dave Kidwell. I'm with NOAA's National Centers for Coastal Ocean Science. And I'll just have a couple quick remarks here just to highlight what NOAA's role is when it comes to the Gulf Hypoxic Dead Zone and some of the actions and activities that we're doing to support management and mitigation efforts that are happening in the watershed and in the coastal waters there. In general, NOAA does have authorization and a mandate from Congress through the Harmful Algal Bloom and Hypoxia Research and Control Act that was initially authorized in 1998, but has been reauthorized several times to do a number of activities, not only in harmful algal blooms, but in particular relevant to this topic, to do a number of activities across the country specific to hypoxia. And so within that realm of the Northern Gulf of Mexico and the Mississippi River watershed, one of the key roles that we play is to provide science support to the Mississippi River Gulf of Mexico Hypoxia Task Force that you'll hear about here in more detail shortly from Mr. Pigott from US EPA. But in general, what we do is we provide research that characterizes the magnitude and the extent, really kind of what you just heard from Dr. Rabelais. We provide the funding and some of the research support that she and others use to document and characterize the hypoxic zone. We also develop some of the modeling that goes into not only understanding what the dynamics of the hypoxic zone or the dead zone are going to look like, but also what the connection is to the watershed and what some of the causative factors are in terms of driving the dead zone. And we also look at what the impacts are in terms of what it means to living resources in the Northern Gulf of Mexico. Obviously, this is an area of very strong fisheries, whether it's shrimp or fin fish. And so we look at and we try to understand what the impacts are to those living marine resources in the Northern Gulf of Mexico. As Dr. Rabelais mentioned, this cruise has been ongoing for some time now. This is actually the 37th annual measurement that we've had that started back in 1985. And it really does provide the annual metric that drives a lot of the decision-making and a lot of the efforts that have been taking place in much of that intervening time to mitigate nutrients in the Mississippi River watershed. And this size this year that Nancy in our press release highlighted of a size of 3,058 or 3,060, if you're rounding square miles, is a bit smaller than we initially predicted, but it is nonetheless somewhat in line with what the more recent five-year average has been, which has been about 4,347 square miles. So again, somewhat similar to what it was last year. But nonetheless, this is a bit larger, about two times larger than what the current goals that you'll hear about here shortly from the Hypoxia Task Force have predicted or are focused on. In terms of what NOAA had predicted earlier this year, so some of the models that we employ to understand the hypoxic zone are also used to make a prediction each early summer, usually in early June, about what the size is. While we had predicted a smaller than average hypoxic zone this year, nonetheless, our prediction of 4,155 square miles was a bit bigger than the measured size. And as Dr. Rabelais highlighted, that is primarily driven by what was fairly low water levels and discharge from the Mississippi River, particularly in the month of June. When we conduct our forecast models earlier in the summer, obviously we're making our best predictions of what the conditions that are expected to be are. But it also assumes somewhat average levels of discharge, average temperatures, et cetera. And so with the below average discharge from the Mississippi River, that was likely one of the key drivers for why it was lower than predicted. We typically also do, using some of our characteristic and understanding models that we have, we'll do a retrospective analysis at the end of this whole season to really help us continue to better understand what the interplay is between weather, between the various inputs from the Mississippi River, as well as a lot of the other physical and biological factors that are at play here when it comes to the hypoxic zone R. The other thing I'll highlight before turning over the microphone is we are investing in potential advanced technologies to perhaps augment or complement the annual cruise. Obviously, for those of you that have been around for a number of years now, the annual metric, which is really the hallmark of how we monitor the hypoxic zone, is at somewhat can be vulnerable to tropical storms and other impacts that might limit our ability to measure the hypoxic zone. And so we're increasingly assessing the potential for automated or unpersoned or uncrewed vehicles, whether they're on the surface or underwater, that could be sent out and provide somewhat continuous or longer term monitoring to complement the work that Nancy and her team does at LSU and LUMCON. And so those efforts are underway to evaluate how we can best augment the crews with some advanced technologies that are really coming to the forefront of how we're understanding and working to employ tools that can help us understand the hypoxic zone and oceanography in general. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks and turn it back over to Paul. Thank you.
Thank you, Dave. All right, next up, we have Bruno Piggott from EPA and our proxy co-chair of the Hypoxia Task Force.
Well, thank you very much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate being part of this today. This is such an important topic. You know, the first thing I thought of when preparing for this discussion was my work on the Ohio River Sanitation Commission. I was a commissioner, and we tracked algal blooms in the Ohio River due to nutrient loadings. And while it might seem odd to experience an algal bloom on a river which has got moving water, recently we're seeing more and more of these blooms in places we would not likely to have seen them in the past. And eventually, of course, what happens on the Ohio River makes it its way to the Gulf. The process of nutrient loadings and the results in terms of Gulf hypoxia is not something we can afford to ignore. I don't have to tell you all, but each year the Mississippi River delivers enormous amounts of water containing nitrogen and phosphorus to the northern Gulf of Mexico, creating hypoxic conditions and impacting local waters along the way. Reducing nutrient loads from this huge landscape is no small feat. And we have some daunting goals. The current Gulf Hypoxia Action Plan strives to reduce the 5-year running average extent of the hypoxic zone to less than 5,000 square kilometers. That is 3,106 miles by 2035. And the action plan's interim target is to reduce nitrogen and phosphorus loads by 20% by 2025. Well, the news today that the dead zone is about 3,058 square miles and the 5-year average is 4,347 square miles shows a lower number. It can often, as Nancy indicated, be attributed to the conditions in the lower flow of the river due to droughts. And indications of high organic loadings, I mean, we have much more work to do. You know, we're using our strong federal partnerships to encourage research, monitoring, and taking action to reduce our nutrient loadings. We'd be at a loss without our state partners. Through state-level collaboration, we're able to track the state-level water quality and actions taken toward meeting the goal of reducing the hypoxic zone. The USGS has shown that when compared to baseline loads from the 80s and 90s, total nitrogen loading decreased by 23%, but total phosphorus loads have unfortunately increased. This administration knows we have much work to do. That's why President Biden's bipartisan infrastructure law provides for the first time dedicated sustained funding to empower hypoxia task force members to reduce nutrient loads and improve water quality. The bipartisan infrastructure law is investing over $60 million over the next 5 years to help 12 Mississippi basin states and tribes implement nutrient reduction strategies. For example, Arkansas is constructing 2-stage ditches to reduce agricultural nutrient runoff and mitigate flooding. Iowa is supporting trusted agricultural advisors to help farmers implement the Iowa nutrient reduction strategy. Illinois is expanding the state's cover crop program. And those are just starts. States have produced work plans that will advance water quality actions while providing numerous environmental co-benefits for disadvantaged communities. It's also important to note that the bipartisan infrastructure law also includes $11.7 billion investment in clean water infrastructure that will support all states, including the hypoxia task force states, in meeting our water quality goals. Through this funding and EPA's enormous investment in climate smart agriculture. That's $19.5 billion under the Inflation Reduction Act. We can make progress like we haven't seen before. These are exciting times. I'm proud to be a part of the team that's working with states and tribes and other partners to reduce the Gulf of hypoxia and the hypoxic zone and improve water quality through the Mississippi River Basin. As a person who has lived in Indiana, I know the challenges before us. I look forward to making progress toward our shared water quality goals. We know that there's a lot of work ahead of us, but we're encouraged that with these resources, we can make a difference. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Pigott. We appreciate it. And I've been informed that you might have to hop off with conflicting meetings. And I just want to let everyone know if there's questions that can't fit into the time a lot that we have for the speakers or the Q&A, you can submit them to the email in the chat, and I'll make sure they're distributed to the correct point of contact.
Thank you, Mr. Mickle. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. So next up, we have Secretary Mike Nagy from the state of Iowa. He's the Secretary of Agriculture. And Mike, please let me know if you have any audio issues. Go ahead.
Bet, and thank you, Paul. And Bruno, always always good to appear with you and as co-chairs, especially thank you to you and Radhika for your commitment to the states and this partnership. So thank you, Paul. Thanks to all who've joined us today. And I do want to add my thanks to the Cruz and research team for their work. So I am the Secretary of Agriculture for the state of Iowa, but in my participating in this conference today, it's in my capacity as the co-chair on behalf of the states for the Gulf of Mexico Hypoxia Task Force. And the construction of the task force, joining together the federal family of agencies with states across the region, really does allow for coordination and collaboration. And it's also been a venue, an important venue, to address barriers that exist to making progress, to addressing resource and research needs. So we appreciate that ongoing commitment. Water quality is an extraordinarily important issue that requires all stakeholders to work together in an effort to improve water quality and ultimately mitigate the hypoxic zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Context is really important here. We need to keep in mind the significance of the Mississippi River to the basin, to the states in the basin, second largest river in North America, connecting all our parts of 31 states, a drainage basin that spans 1.2 million square miles, and more than 500 million tons of goods shipped down this river at a value of $130 billion annually. It's important. It's important to the many people and businesses and livelihoods, the ability to use the Mississippi as an inland waterway to move goods and support those economies in communities in our states is critically important. We've got a vested interest in protecting the health of this working river, and we also must balance commerce with water quality. We have to have the ability to live, work, and play across this whole region. So the annual measurement that we're talking about today, the size of the hypoxic zone, it's an important piece of information. It's an important indicator. It's used by the task force to judge progress. As we stand today and hear about it being smaller than expected, it's certainly, you know, positive news for the communities directly impacted by the zone each year, that it is smaller this year. However, of course, we have to recognize, as has been mentioned, the variability and the many variables that contribute to the size of the zone from year to year. And it does fluctuate, obviously. Water flow, precipitation throughout the basin, key factors. We have to remember that each year. This year and years where it may be bigger even. But we also must recognize that there is significant progress. Bruno mentioned some of these efforts, and I'll mention a few more. There's impactful work happening across the states. The work is making a difference. We are seeing public and private partnerships take shape. We're seeing states accelerate their work. They're scaling up implementation, and all of that pays dividends for years to come. Now, each state is unique, and so therefore each state is taking on the challenge of reducing nutrient loss in their own way using their own nutrient reduction strategies, and that's as it should be. States are also developing various dedicated funding sources. Bruno mentioned the necessity of sustained funding, and of course we do have a historic opportunity to leverage state and federal resources to really have a step change in momentum. Because each state is different, we've got unique geographic features. Our plans address specific needs of states and communities. And again, we're appreciative of the dollars that specifically EPA has brought to the table here for states. I do want to highlight a couple of the positive things that are happening, some of the progress that we're seeing. We in Iowa commemorated our 10th anniversary of our nutrient reduction strategy this spring. We saw positive results showing reduced nutrient loss. We've signed an expanded partnership with Ducks Unlimited to construct 60 additional wetlands. What this really does is allow us to expand our private sector capacity. We're batching conservation practices together and building them more efficiently. And we saw record usage of our cost share program, and we continue to expect to see record use of our cost share program each year. That's our focus. Arkansas, a nutrient reduction viewer, has recently been released that provides modeled nitrogen and phosphorus reductions due to conservation practice implementation. Bruno mentioned their two-stage ditch construction project. Minnesota recently completed watershed restoration and protection strategies for the rest of their 80 watersheds in their state. These are plans that local partners can use to guide implementation. The legislature increased funding, $21 million for soil health activities, $17 million for water storage, and this is in addition to the $79 million that they already had in place for the biennium. Wisconsin, supporting grower-led water protection groups, funding $5 million to 45 producer-led groups since 2015. They're working on a nitrogen optimization pilot program, crop insurance premium rebates for cover crops, and additional grants. Illinois has added 40 conservation planters and expanded their cover crop incentive program. Missouri, through an extensive stakeholder process, established a total phosphorus rule targeting reductions from point source facilities, which once implemented will reduce total phosphorus loading from Missouri point sources affected by the rule by 60%. They implemented $40 million in soil and water conservation practices last year using their parks, soils, and water sales tax. Indiana set a record in 22 for conservation practice installation at 47,000 new practices, and that was up over 15,000 from the previous year. Ohio, the H2 Ohio Water Quality Program continues to expand, including wetlands and stream restoration. Kentucky, 3,300 ag water quality plans farmers have now developed using their planning tool, which again allows them to then implement practices to reduce sediment and nitrogen loading. So these are just a sampling of some of the success stories that I want to share as the co-chair representing the state's task force. So the work remains. We've got to focus on scaling up, accelerating the adoption of practices. We're building momentum, and that we'll have to continue to do that to see the progress that we want to see. This annual measurement is just one of the ways that we can measure progress and measure our efforts. But we know there's more work to do. There's significant funding, technical and construction resource needs. We've got to have more people, more businesses, more municipalities, farmers, landowners, all of the above saying yes. They want to implement new practices, do new things to move us forward. So I'll just conclude by saying I want to again thank all of the partners, every partner on behalf of the states who are working with us across the region on this this journey to make impactful progress on the Mississippi River Basin. It's only by working together and leveraging our collective resources that we can ever hope to accelerate and scale up to the level that we need to. So thank you.
Thank you, Secretary Nag. And our last panelist will be Lori Sprague from United States Geological Survey, and then we'll open it up for the Q&A with the press. Thank you. Go ahead, Lori.
Thank you, Paul. Good morning, everyone. I'm Lori Sprague, and I am the U.S. Department of the Interior and U.S. Geological Survey representative on the Hypoxia Task Force Coordinating Committee. Like NOAA, the role of the Department of the Interior on the task force is to provide scientific support to help understand more about what the sources of nutrients are and how they move throughout the Mississippi River Basin. As part of that support, the USGS has monitored nutrients in the Mississippi River since the 1970s. This long-term observational record is updated with new monitoring data each year, and it's used to both forecast and understand the size of the zone each year, as well as to track progress toward nutrient reduction goals set by the task force. This year, stream flow in the Mississippi and Atchafalaya rivers during May was about 33% below the long-term average, and nitrogen and phosphorus loads were about 42% and 5% below the long-term average, respectively. These lower levels were one factor contributing to the smaller than average size of the hypoxic zone this year. Over the longer term, recent science indicates that both nitrogen and phosphorus loads from the Mississippi River Basin into the Gulf will need to be reduced by 48% to meet the 2035 goal of reducing the five-year average size of the hypoxic zone to less than 5,000 square kilometers. As you heard earlier, in support of that 2035 goal, the task force has also set an earlier interim goal of reducing nitrogen and phosphorus loads by 20% by the year 2025. The task force tracks reductions in nutrient loading from the Mississippi River Basin by comparing nitrogen and phosphorus loads delivered to the Gulf each year to a baseline period from 1980 to 1996. When that comparison is made, we want to be able to understand the role of changing stream flow each year, and that's because higher stream flows in the Mississippi River Basin will carry more nutrients to the Gulf, irrespective of any other actions we are taking in the basin to manage nutrients. Likewise, lower stream flows will carry fewer nutrients. So to track nutrient loading changes that are more likely the result of nutrient management and other human activities, USGS controls for that short-term variability in loads due to year-to-year changes in stream flow during analysis of long-term change, resulting in what we call a flow normalized load. The USGS has found that flow normalized nitrogen loads from the Mississippi River Basin into the Gulf of Mexico decreased below the 20% interim reduction target in the years 2020 and 2021. Overall, the change in flow normalized nitrogen loads between that 1980 to 1996 baseline and 2021, which is the most recent year with available trend results, was estimated to be a decrease of 23%. In contrast, the change in flow normalized phosphorus loads between the baseline and 2021 was estimated to be a slight increase of 3%. In the case of both nitrogen and phosphorus, more work is needed to reach that 48% reduction in loading needed to meet the 2035 goal for the size of the hypoxic zone. Thank you.
Thank you, Lori. We appreciate it. And I want to thank all of our panelists for their statements on this part of the press conference. So I want to go ahead and open it up to the press. And I want to remind everyone, you can put your question into the chat, or you can just say, I have a question, and we will unmute you and you can ask the question verbally. So whatever you prefer, but I'm going to go ahead and open it up. You can ask a question toward a panelist or generalize to the panel itself. Feel free to initiate your questions now. All right, well, folks are entering in their questions and requests. Let's see, so, all right. So we have a question in the chat and it's to the entire panel. It is from Justin Gertz. And I wanna identify the question is, how much does warmer than average water temperatures influence the size of the hypoxic zone compared to the nutrient discharge? I probably, that's more of a Nancy question in her wheelhouse. So I'll go ahead and prompt Nancy. Did you understand the question and can you see it in the chat or do you need me to repeat it?
I'm unmuted now. Okay, thank you. So temperatures, the warmer waters do not hold as much low oxygen, do not hold as much dissolved oxygen as cooler waters. The bottom waters were cool compared to the surface waters. So there was no, obvious effect of the bottom waters on the low oxygen, but the surface waters were definitely warm and were probably warmer during the time that the phytoplankton production was occurring, because as we know, the temperatures are overall lower this year than previous years. The main driver, though, is the discharge of the Mississippi River, at least from our data right now. We are looking into long-term trends of temperature.
Thank you, Nancy. All right, so we have another question from Mark Schlestein. And the question is, what were scientists seeing during testing? Example, fish, crabs attempting to escape, or odors of samples. So what was it like out there, Nancy, as far as what were the scientists seeing, and really, is there anything unique to this year or any animal behavior that was identified in the,
okay,
the sampling process?
All right. The odors that we got were hydrogen sulfide, which is toxic to animals. And that was in the very bottom waters that were close to anoxic or no oxygen. And that smell could be smelled, that odor could be smelled during the collection of the water once it was back on board, but we couldn't smell it from the surface. We did see, and I'm saying we, the Royal We, I was actually not on the cruise, but monitoring it the whole time. There were crabs that were swimming at the surface, and that's usually a sign of low oxygen on the bottom, and those correlated where the oxygen, where we did see animals at the surface, crabs and fish, the oxygen at the bottom was low or very low. So that's an indication of low oxygen as well that we can visibly see.
Great, Nancy. Okay. So now we have a question from Melina Walling. And the question is, when will we know whether long-term progress is really being made on the size of the hypoxic zone given year-to-year variability? So I guess that one is more for Nancy or Dave, as far as long-term trends and when will we know? So feel free to respond.
Well, this is Nancy. Can you hear me?
Sure, and Lori has chimed in. She'd okay. like to answer as well. So go ahead, Nancy, first.
Okay. The prediction is it's gonna take a long time. And the prediction is based on the amount of nutrients that can be reduced in the discharge of the river. So there's no known time limit. Lori, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay, thanks, Nancy. Yeah, that's a great question. And I touched on this a little bit in my remarks. That year-to-year variability in stream flow, which contributes to year-to-year variability in nutrient loads, is not a systematic long-term trend. That's just largely natural variability. So we don't want to consider that as part of our long-term trend analysis. That's why we control for it. So the flow normalized metric is an indication of a systematic long-term trend in nutrient loads. We've done some research within USGS as to what might be contributing to those trends. For example, we've looked at the balance between nutrient inputs in the basin, which include things like urban and agricultural fertilizer use, livestock manure, atmospheric deposition, treated wastewater, things like that. The balance between those and outputs, which include nutrient uptake and removal in crops. That's long been recognized as one driver of long-term changes in nutrient loading to the Gulf of Mexico, because any input in excess of output is available to run off to rivers. That balance has been consistently positive over the years. That is, we've had inputs in excess of outputs, and that surplus, for many years, it increased. But recently, despite a consistent surplus, the rate of increase in that balance, particularly for nitrogen, has slowed in recent decades. And for phosphorus, it's started to decline, which is an important finding because that shows that improving management of nutrients so that inputs are better aligned with crop needs has slowed the rate of surpluses. And that indicates some success in controlling nutrients at the source. Those nutrient balances have been positively correlated with nutrient loads in the river, between about 1975 and 1985. But after 1985, we started to see other factors become important. So for nitrogen, the increase in nitrogen balances since 1975 have increased river loads, but those increases were offset by other factors that had more of an effect starting in the mid 1980s and helped reduce nutrient loads, particularly nitrogen, over time. We've estimated that if these other factors had not been in effect, nitrogen loads from the Mississippi River Basin to the Gulf might have doubled instead since the mid 1980s. In the case of phosphorus, these other factors were even more important, but with mixed effects, they contributed to decreases between 2000 and 2010 in river loads, but since have contributed to increasing loads of phosphorus. And so you're probably wondering what some of these other factors are. The answer is that we don't yet know definitively. A big part of the challenge is that many of these other possible factors have not been consistently tracked over time since the 1970s across the whole basin, meaning we don't have historical data to evaluate their effects directly. Based on our understanding of nutrient sources in the basin and the factors that affect their movement from the land surface to rivers, we believe that these other factors include some combination of nutrient management, agricultural best management practices, lagged inputs of nutrients that are stored in the basin since their use over the last few decades, possibly the effects of tile drainage and or the effects of climate change.
And Paul, this is Dave. I can jump in with just one quick additional comment. One of the ways that we do try to at least account for some of that year-to-year variability when we measure the size of the dead zone is you might have been hearing us refer to the five-year average. And so when we provide a metric or we provide an estimate, we provide it both in terms of what it was in a given year, but for tracking progress towards the goals of the hypoxia task force and assessing progress and reductions of the size of the hypoxic or dead zone, we use this five-year average. And so what that does is it allows us to try to smooth out that interannual variability in terms of them, there's additional extraneous conditions such as weather and other factors that might be coming into play. And it allows us to look at that more long-term trend and how we're assessing progress towards our goals. So that's how we use or why we use that five-year running average to really as our core metric for assessing progress.
This is Nancy. If we continue to have droughts in the summer, that's going to affect the low oxygen over the years as well.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Lori, Dave, and Nancy. Those are great responses. So we have a couple more questions, and please feel free to enter more into the chat. So next we have two questions from Mark Schleffstein. We'll go ahead and ask the first one is, what efforts will be made to require TMDL or total maximum daily load limits to stream segments on nutrients? I guess this one kind of falls in the wheelhouse of either Mr. Pigott from EPA or Mike Nag, Secretary Nag from the state of Iowa. I think Mr. Pigott had a conflict. So Mike, if feel free to answer the question. If not, I can forward the question to Mr. Pigott.
Yeah, I would really have to, I would defer to EPA on that.
Yeah, that falls in the EPA's realm. So no problem. So Mr. Schleffstein, I will make sure that question is sent via email to Mr. Pigott for response. And the next question is, what status of expanding crews to east side of Mississippi River into Mississippi, Alabama? So what's the status of expanding that that sampling regime or transect area focus? Is there Dave or Nancy?
I'll answer that.
Sure.
We've submitted a proposal to the Gulf of Mexico Alliance that was approved to begin sampling on the eastern side of the river, based on the Infrastructure Act. So it's just 2 years. However, the first year didn't happen in 2023 because the paperwork hadn't been completed in time for us to to start spending money. And in fact, it still hasn't been completed. I'm not sure why. And so that's just for those 2 years. From history, occurrences of low oxygen east of the river occur in high flow years, and we've mapped one of those areas, but and in other years it's in different places east of the river. And I suspect this year with the low flow in the summer that it might not have at least been there in the summertime, unless the surface water temperatures just really drove it down. So stay tuned, and when we get the money, we'll start looking at least for 2 years at the other side of the river.
And this is Dave from NOAA. I can add that, unfortunately, we only have enough funding to support the main cruise that is west of the river that Nancy described. I know that as she just articulated, she's been exploring additional sources of funding. We have in the past, during high flow occurrences, provided supplemental, but that was on an as needed and really funding was available basis. As typically, as I mentioned, we only have enough funding, unfortunately, to fund the cruise west of the river on an annual basis.
Thank you. All right, so I don't see additional questions in the chat. Feel free to add them, but I really want to give folks on the phone a chance to have their questions to be able to be presented. So we're going to go ahead and open it up and identify folks. We're going to unmute callers. Just please identify yourself, your press link of who you work for and publish with, and feel free to ask the question to the panel or a specific panelist. All right, we're unmuting
this
now.
This is Nancy. Can I make a comment?
Absolutely, go ahead.
Okay, as Laurie explained, there's a lot of variability in the river, and there's a lot of variability in nutrient loads, which affect production, phytoplankton production in the Gulf of Mexico that eventually leads to the low oxygen. And there are also very many, many factors offshore in the area of the low oxygen that affect its distribution and size. Somebody, I think, did mention hurricanes. That will reduce the size, and winds from the west will reduce the size. Droughts obviously reduce the size. So there's a lot of variability in the manifestation of the low oxygen in the offshore waters, and we need to think about all these things as we look for success.
Thank you, Dr. Rabelais. All right, so we've unmuted the callers. Go ahead and ask your question now, if you have one. You'll probably have to unmute yourself on your end. Okay. Well, if there's not a question from the callers, that's fine. We're going to leave you unmuted. Feel free to interrupt me if you have technical difficulties and figure it out. So don't worry about that. Feel free to interrupt. So anybody there still? Any questions? Okay. Well, I have one last question, and then we'll start to wrap up as we have a hard stop at the hour as everyone else has additional meetings, and we don't want to lose panelists to not be able to answer questions. So my questions to Dave Kidwell with NOAA, I have a question about what types of future modeling efforts, if any, is NOAA looking into as far as what might be useful and already being done in hypoxia as far as projections and biological impact projections as we try to understand. We have such wonderful long-running data that models start to really become very useful tools, and I know that we do current models. Dave, do you have anything to share about just specific, maybe some new types of models or any research that might be on the horizon with this effort?
Yeah, I can give a couple of remarks to that quickly here, Paul. As you mentioned, we have been supporting modeling efforts really with an emphasis on characterizing the causes and the sources of those causes of the hypoxygen, in particular, the relationship between nitrogen and phosphorus inputs, as well as overall discharge from the Mississippi River. And those models, we've got a couple of those that we've supported or are currently helping to maintain, are doing a fairly good job of establishing those connections and helping us to make the understanding of what are causing it. But as you mentioned, the sort of next frontier that we've been working on for some time now, but nonetheless is what really kind of where we see on the horizon is really incorporating those living marine resource impacts. One of the challenges that we have is that, while understanding impacts to living marine resources like shrimp or croaker or redfish or other organisms in that part of the Gulf of Mexico is important, it's a bit of a challenge. It's an open shelf. It's not like a small bay, or it's not like a small river or lake where you've got a fairly confined area and can study organisms, very particular organisms on what their specific impacts are. It's an open system, so it's taking us some time to get the underlying data needed to understand what the physiological impacts to these organisms are, how they respond behaviorally to the hypoxic zone, as well as what the implications of those behavior changes are. We are seeing impacts through some of those studies. And so really the next phase of this is really trying to integrate a lot of these types of efforts into our models, trying to better not only relate the size of the hypoxic zone to living marine resource impacts, but also then arguably more importantly, being able to understand what various scenarios of changes in nutrient inputs will have on those living marine resources more directly, as well as changes in river discharge. And so that's really the horizon in terms of trying to improve our modeling capacity and efforts to inform how we manage and potentially mitigate some of the impacts of hypoxia there.
Thank you, Dave. I really appreciate that. And I want to thank all of our panelists today and the press that joined us. It's really been a great event. And I just want to say very quickly that NGI and NOAA are so proud of this panel and this task force. When you really look at it from, an American interest perspective, it's really showing how state and federal entities, agencies and institutions are working together with all the same goal. And I can't emphasize how easy it is to get in our silos of our agencies and institutes and not be able to work across. And this is one of those groups that has really excelled at it. And I'm just really proud to have been a part of it and look forward to the advancements and of already what's occurred as we learn more. And we hope that this has been an informative press event. And one last thing, if you have additional questions or requests, feel free to email them to sheila@hpc.msstate.edu, and that address is in the chat box. And I think on the press invite and registration list is also some additional emails that will prompt and be able to answer questions. So again, at this time, I'm going to go ahead and call it, but we'll keep it open for the email questions, and we will do our due diligence to make sure that they are distributed to the correct point of contacts and answered in a timely manner. So thank you all very much and have a terrific week.